That's what artists are like.
I suppose so, I said.
I could never be an artist, Masahiko said with a sigh.
That might be the only thing I learned from my father. Didn't you tell me before that when he was young he was pretty wild and did whatever he liked?
By the time I was big, he wasn't like that anymore. But when he was young, he played around a lot, apparently. He was tall, good-looking, a young guy from a wealthy family, and a talented painter. How could women not be drawn to him? And he was certainly fond of the ladies. Rumor is that he had some affairs that his family had to pay to clear up. But my relative said that after he returned from his time abroad, he was a different person.
A different person?
After he returned to Japan, he didn't play around anymore, and just stayed at home focusing on his painting. And he didn't socialize anymore. After he got back to Tokyo, he was a bachelor for a long time, but once he could earn a good living painting, like the idea had just occurred to him, he suddenly and unexpectedly married a distant relative back home. For all the world, like he was balancing the account book of his life or something. It was a late marriage for him, and then I was born. I have no clue if he ever played around with other women after he got married, though I can say that he no longer made a show of having a good time.
Quite a change.
His parents were really happy, though, at how he'd changed. No more messy affairs for them to clean up. But none of our relatives could tell me what had happened to him in Vienna, or why he rejected Western painting in favor of Japanese-style art. When it came to those things, my father's mouth was clamped shut, like an oyster at the bottom of the sea.
And even if you pried open that shell now, there would be nothing inside. I thanked Masahiko and hung up. It was by total coincidence that I discovered the painting by Tomohiko Amada, the one with the unusual title, Killing Commendatore. Sometimes in the middle of the night, I'd hear a faint rustling sound from the attic above the bedroom. At first I thought it must be mice, or a squirrel that had found its way into the attic. But the sound was clearly not that of a rodent's feet scurrying around, nor that of a slithering snake. It sounded more like oil paper being crumpled up. Not loud enough to keep me from sleeping, but it did concern me that there was some unknown creature in the house. I figured it might be an animal that could cause some damage. After searching around, I located the opening to the attic in the ceiling in the back of the guest bedroom closet. I lugged over the aluminum ladder from the storage shed and, flashlight in one hand, pushed open the cover. I timidly stuck my head through and looked around. The attic was bigger than I'd thought, and dark. A small amount of sunlight filtered in through the small vent holes on either side. I shone the flashlight around, but didn't see anything. At least nothing was moving. I took the plunge and hauled myself up into the attic. The place smelled dusty, but not enough to bother me. The attic was apparently well ventilated and there wasn't much dust on the floor. Several thick beams hung low on the ceiling, but as long as I avoided them, I could walk around okay. I edged forward and checked both vents. Both were covered with screens, so no animals could get in, but the screen on the north vent had a gap in it. Something might have knocked against it and ripped it. Or else an animal had intentionally ripped the wire to get inside. Either way, the opening was large enough for a smallish animal to easily scramble in. I spotted the culprit I'd been hearing at night, silently settled on top of a beam in the dark. It was a small, gray-horned owl. The owl's eyes were closed, and it seemed to be sleeping. I switched off my flashlight and stood away to silently observe without frightening it. I'd never seen a horned owl up close before. It looked less like an owl than like a cat with wings. It was a beautiful creature. The owl most likely rested here during the day, and then at night, went out the vent hole to hunt for prey in the mountains. The sound of it going in and out must have been what woke me. No harm done. Having an owl in the attic also meant I needn't worry about mice and snakes settling in. I figured I should just leave it be. I felt close to the little owl. Both of us just happened to be borrowing this house and sharing it. It could have the run of the attic as far as I was concerned. I enjoyed observing it for a time, then tiptoed back where I'd come from. That's when I discovered the large wrapped package near the entrance. One look told me it was a wrapped-up painting. About 3 feet in height and 5 feet in length, it was wrapped tightly in brown Japanese wrapping paper with string tied several times around it. Nothing else was in the attic. The faint sunlight filtering in from the vent holes, the gray-horned owl on top of a beam, the wrapped painting propped up against a wall. The combination felt magical, somehow, and captivated me. I gingerly lifted the package. It wasn't heavy, the weight of a painting set in a simple frame. The wrapping paper was slightly dusty. It must have been placed here, out of anyone's sight, quite some time ago. A name tag was attached tightly with wire to the string. In blue ballpoint ink was written Killen Commendatore. The writing was done in a very careful hand. Most likely, this was the title of the painting. Naturally, I had no clue why that one painting would be hidden away in the attic. I considered what I should do. Obviously, the correct thing to do would be to leave it where it was. This was Tomohiko Amada's house, not mine. The painting, clearly his possession. Presumably, it was one that he himself had painted. One that, for whatever reason, he had hidden away so no one would see it. That being the case, I thought I shouldn't do anything uncalled for and should let it continue to silently share the attic with the owl. I should just leave it be. That made the most sense, but still I couldn't suppress the curiosity surging up inside. The words in what appeared to be the title, Killen Commendatore, grabbed me. What kind of painting could it be? And why did Tomohiko Amada have to hide away this painting alone in the attic? I picked up the painting and tested to see if it could squeeze through the opening to the attic. Logic dictated that a painting that had been brought up here shouldn't have any problem being carried down, and there was no other entrance to the attic. But still, I checked to see if it would squeeze through. As expected, it was a tight fit, but when I held it diagonally, it squeezed through the square opening. I imagined Tomohiko Amada carrying the painting up to the attic. He must have been by himself then, carrying around some secret inside him. I could vividly imagine the scene, as if I were actually witnessing it. I don't think Amada would be angry if he found out I'd brought the painting down from the attic. His mind was buried now in a deep maelstrom, according to his son, unable to distinguish an opera from a frying pan. He would never be coming back to this home. And if I left this painting in an attic with the screen over the vent hole ripped, mice and squirrels might gnaw away at it someday. Or else bugs might get to it. And if this painting really was by Tomohiko Amada, this would be a substantial loss to the art world. I lowered the package on top of the shelf in the closet, gave a little wave to the horned owl huddled on the beam, then clambered down and quietly shut the lid to the entrance. I didn't unwrap the painting right away. I left that brown package propped up against the wall in the studio for several days, and I sat on the floor, gazing vaguely at it. It was hard for me to decide whether I should unwrap it or not. I mean, it belonged to somebody else, and whatever positive spin you might try to put on it, I didn't have the right to unwrap it. If I wanted to, at least I should get permission from his son, Masahiko.
I'm not sure why, but I didn't feel like letting Masahiko know the painting existed. I felt like it was something personal, just between me and Tomohiko Amada. I can't explain why, but that's how I felt. I stared at the painting, my assumption, of course, that it was actually a painting, wrapped in Japanese paper and tied tightly with string, so hard I almost burned a hole in it. And after running the next step through my mind over and over, I finally decided to unwrap it. It was no contest. My curiosity won out over any sense of etiquette or common sense. Whether this was the professional curiosity of an artist or simple personal curiosity, I couldn't say. Whatever, I just had to see what was inside. I don't care what anyone says, I told myself. I brought over scissors, cut the tightly bound string, and peeled away the brown wrapping paper. I took my time and did it carefully, in case I needed to rewrap it again later on. Underneath the layers of wrapping paper was a painting in a simple frame, wrapped in a soft white cloth like bleached cotton. I gently lifted off that cloth, as carefully as if I were removing the bandages from a burn victim. What was revealed under the white cloth was, as expected, a Japanese-style painting. A long, rectangular painting. I stood it up on a shelf, stood back a bit, and studied it. It was Tomohiko Amada's work, no doubt about it. Clearly done in his style and inimitable technique, with his signature bold use of space and dynamic composition. The painting depicted men and women dressed in the fashions of the Asuka period, the clothes and hairstyles of that age. But the painting startled me nonetheless. What it depicted was so violent, it took my breath away. As far as I knew, Tomohiko Amada hardly ever painted pictures that were harsh and violent, maybe never. His paintings mostly summoned up feelings of nostalgia, gentleness, and peace. Occasionally, they would take up historical events as his theme, but the people depicted in them generally faded away into the overall composition. They were shown as part of a close community in the midst of the abundant natural scenery of ancient times, a steaming harmony above all. Ego was submerged in the collective will, or absorbed into a calm fate, and the circle of life was quietly drawn closed. For Tomohiko Amada, that very well may have been utopia. Over the years, he continued to depict that world from all sorts of angles, all sorts of perspectives. Many called his style a rejection of modernity or a return to antiquity. Of course, there were some who criticized it as escapist. In any case, after he returned to Japan from studying in Vienna, he abandoned modernist oil painting and shut himself away inside that kind of serene world without a single word of explanation or justification. But this painting titled Killing Commendatore was full of blood. Realistic blood flowing all over. Two men were fighting with heavy ancient swords in what seemed to be a duel. One of the men fighting was young, the other old. The young man had plunged his sword deep into the old man's chest. The young man had a thin black mustache and wore tight-fitting light greenish clothes. The old man was dressed in white and had a lush white beard. Around his neck was a necklace of beads. He had dropped his sword, which had not yet struck the ground. Blood was spewing from his chest. The tip of the sword must have pierced his aorta. The blood had soaked his white clothes, and his mouth was twisted in agony. His eyes were wide open, staring in disbelief into space. He realized he was defeated.
but the real pain had yet to hit him. For his part, the young man's eyes were cold, fixed on his opponent. Not a sign of regret in those eyes, not a hint of confusion or fear, or a trace of agitation. Totally composed, those eyes were simply watching the impending death of another, and his own unmistakable victory. The gushing blood was nothing more than proof of that, and elicited no emotional reaction whatsoever. Honestly, until then, I had thought of Japanese-style paintings as static and formulaic, their techniques and subject matter ill-suited to the expression of strong emotion, a world that had nothing to do with me. But looking now at Tomohiko Amada's Killing Commendatore, I realized that had been nothing but prejudice on my part. In Amada's depiction of the two men's violent duel to the death, was something that shook the viewer to the core. The man who won, the man who lost, the man who stabbed and the man who was stabbed. My heart was captured by the discrepancy. There is something very special about this painting, I thought. There were a few other figures nearby watching the duel. One was a young woman. She had on refined, pure white clothes. Her hair was done up with a large hair ornament. She held one hand in front of her mouth, which was slightly parted. She looked like she was about to take a deep breath and let out a scream. Her lovely eyes were wide open. And there was another young man there. His clothes were not as splendid, dark clothes. Bereft of any ornaments, the kind of outfit designed to be easy to move around in. On his feet were plain-looking Zori sandals. He looked like a servant. He had no long sword, just a short sword hanging from his waist. He was short and thick-set, with a scraggly beard. In his left hand, he held a kind of account book, like a clipboard that a company employee nowadays might have. His right hand was reaching out in the air as if to grab something, but it couldn't grab anything. You couldn't tell from the painting if he was the servant of the old man, or of the young man, or of the woman. One thing that was clear, though, was that this duel had taken place quickly, and neither the woman nor the servant had expected it to happen. Both of their faces revealed an unmistakable shock at the sudden turn of events. The only one of the four who wasn't surprised was the young man doing the killing. Probably nothing ever took him by surprise. He was not a born killer, and he didn't enjoy killing, but if it served his purpose, he wouldn't hesitate to kill. He was young, burning with idealism, though of what kind I have no idea, a man overflowing with strength. And he was skilled in the art of wielding a sword. Seeing an old man past his prime dying by his hand didn't surprise him. It was, in fact, a natural, rational act. There was one other person there, an odd observer. The man was at the bottom left of the painting, much like a footnote in a text. His head was peeking out from a lid in the ground that he had partially pushed open. The lid was square and made of boards. It reminded me of the attic cover in this house. The shape and size were identical. From there, the man was watching the people on the surface. A hole opening up to the surface? A square manhole? No way. They didn't have sewers back in the Asuka period, and the duel was taking place outdoors in an empty, vacant lot. The only thing visible in the background was a pine tree with low-hanging branches. Why would there be a hole with a cover there, in the middle of a vacant lot? It didn't make any sense.
The man who was sticking his head out of the hole was weird-looking. He had an unusually long face, like a twisted eggplant. His face was overgrown with a black beard, his hair long and tangled. He looked like some sort of vagabond or hermit who'd abandoned the world. In a way, he also looked like someone who'd lost his mind. But the glint in his eyes was surprisingly sharp, insightful even. That said, the insight there wasn't the product of reason, but rather something induced by a sort of deviance, perhaps something akin to madness. I couldn't tell the details of what he was wearing, since all that I could see was from the neck up. He, too, was watching the duel. But unlike the others, he showed no surprise at the turn of events. He was a mere observer of something that was supposed to take place, as if checking all the details of the incident just to be sure. The young woman and the servant weren't aware of the man with the long face behind them. Their eyes were riveted on the bloody duel. No one was about to turn around. But who was this person? And why was he hiding beneath the ground back in ancient times? What was Tomohiko Amada's purpose in deliberately including this uncanny, mysterious figure in one corner of the painting, and thus forcibly destroying the balance of the overall composition? And why in the world was this painting given the title Killing Commendatore? True, an apparently high-ranking person was being killed in the picture, but that old man in his ancient garb certainly didn't deserve to be called a commendatore, a knight commander. That was a title clearly from the European Middle Ages or the early modern period. There was no position like that in Japanese history. But still, Tomohiko Amada gave it this strange-sounding title, Killing Commendatore. There had to be a reason. The term commendatore sparked a faint memory. I'd heard the word before. I followed that trace of memory, as if tugging a thin thread toward me. I'd run across the word in a novel or drama, and it was a famous work. I knew I'd seen it somewhere. And then it hit me. Mozart's opera, Don Giovanni. In the beginning of that opera was a scene, I was sure, of killing commendatore. I went over to the shelf of records in the living room, took out the boxed set of Don Giovanni, and read through the accompanying commentary. And sure enough, the person killed in the opening scene was the commendatore. He didn't have a name. He was simply listed as commendatore. The libretto was in Italian, and the old man killed in the beginning was called Il Commendatore. Whoever translated the libretto into Japanese had rendered it as Kishidancho, literally the Knight Commander, and that had become the standard term in Japanese. I had no clue what sort of rank or position the term Commendatore referred to in reality. The commentary in a few other boxed sets didn't elaborate. He was merely a nameless commendatore appearing in the opera with the sole function of being stabbed to death by Don Giovanni in the opening of the opera. And in the end, he transformed into an ominous statue that appeared to Don Giovanni and took him down to hell. Pretty obvious, if you think about it, I thought. The handsome young man in this painting is the rake Don Giovanni, Don Juan in Spanish, and the older man being killed is the honored knight commander. The young woman is the commendatore's beautiful daughter, Donna Anna. The servant is Don Giovanni's man, Leporello. What he had in his hands was the detailed list of all the women Don Giovanni had seduced up until then, a lengthy catalog of names. Don Giovanni had forced himself on Donna Anna, and when her father confronted him with this violation, they had a duel, and Don Giovanni stabbed the older man to death. It's a famous scene. Why hadn't I picked up on that? probably because Mozart's opera and a Japanese-style painting depicting the Asuka period were so remote from each other. So, of course, I hadn't been able to make the connection. But once I did, everything fell into place. Tomohiko Amada had adapted the world of Mozart's opera into the Asuka period. A fascinating experiment, for sure. That I recognized. But why was that adaptation necessary? It was so very different from his usual style of painting, and why did he tightly wrap the painting and hide it away in the attic? And what was the significance of that figure in the bottom left, the man with the long face sticking his head out from underground? In Mozart's Don Giovanni, no one like that appeared. There must have been a reason Tomohiko Amada had added him. Also in the opera, Donna Anna didn't actually witness her father being stabbed to death. She was off asking her lover, the knight Don Ottavio, for help. By the time they got back to the scene, her father had already breathed his last. Amada had, no doubt for dramatic purposes, subtly changed the way the scene played out. But there was no way the man sticking his head out of the ground was Don Ottavio. That man's features weren't anything found in this world. It was impossible that this was the upright, righteous knight who could help Donna Anna. Was he a demon from hell? Scouting out the situation in anticipation of dragging Don Giovanni down to hell? But he didn't look like a demon or devil. A demon wouldn't have such strangely sparkling eyes. A devil wouldn't push a square wooden lid up and peek out. The figure more resembled a trickster who had come to intervene. Long Face is what I called him, for lack of a better term. For a few weeks, I just silently stared at that painting. With it in front of me, I couldn't bring myself to do any painting of my own. I barely even felt like eating. I'd grab whatever vegetables were in the fridge, dip them in mayo, and chew on that, or else heat up a can of whatever I had on hand. That's about the size of it. All day long, I'd sit on the floor of the studio, endlessly listening to the record of Don Giovanni, staring enthralled at Killing Commendatore. When the sun set, I'd have a glass of wine. The painting was amazing. As far as I knew, though, it wasn't reprinted in any collection of Amada's work, which meant no one else knew it existed. If it were made public, it would no doubt become one of his best-known paintings. If they held a retrospective of his art, it wouldn't be surprising if this was the painting used on the promotional poster. This wasn't simply a painting that was wonderfully done, though. The painting was brimming with an extraordinary sort of energy. Anyone with even a little knowledge of art couldn't miss that fact. There was something in this painting that appealed to the deepest part of the viewer's heart. Something suggestive that enticed the imagination to another realm. I couldn't take my eyes off the bearded long face on the left side of the painting. It felt like he'd opened the lid to invite me, personally, to the world underground. No one else, just me. I couldn't stop thinking about what sort of realm lay beneath. Where in the world had he come from? And what did he do there? Would that lid be closed up again, or would it be left open? As I stared at the painting, I listened to that scene from Don Giovanni over and over. Act 1, Scene 3, soon after the overture, and I nearly memorized the lyrics and the lines. Donna Anna. Ah, the assassin has struck him down. This blood, this wound, his face discolored with the pallor of death. He has stopped breathing. His limbs are cold. Oh, father, dear father, dearest father, I'm fainting. I'm dying.
Chapter 6. At this point, he's a faceless client. Summer was winding down when a call came in from my agent. It had been a while since anyone had called me. The summer heat still lingered during the day, though when the sun set, the air in the mountains was chilly. The noisy clamor of the summer cicadas was slowly fading away, but now a chorus of other insects had taken their place. Unlike when I lived in the city, I was surrounded by nature now, and one season freely chipped away at portions of the preceding one. We brought each other up to date, though there wasn't much to tell on my end. "How's your painting coming along?" he asked. "Slowly but surely," I said. This was a lie, of course. It was more than 4 months since I'd moved here, yet the canvas I'd prepared was still blank. "Glad to hear it," he said. "I'd like to see how you're doing sometime. Maybe there's something I can do to help out." "Thanks. We'll do that sometime." Then he told me why he'd called. "I have a request. Are you sure you're not willing to do one more portrait? What do you think?" "I told you I've given up doing portraits." "I know, but the fee this time is unbelievable."
"Unbelievable?"
"It's amazing."
"How amazing?"
He told me the figure. I nearly let out a whistle of surprise. "There have got to be a lot of other people besides me who specialize in portraits," I replied calmly.
"There aren't all that many, really, though there are a few besides you who are fairly decent."
"Then you should ask them. With a fee like that, anybody would jump at the chance."
"The thing is, the other party specifically asked for you. That's their condition. No one else will do."
I shifted the phone to my left hand and scratched behind my right ear. The agent went on. "The person saw several portraits you've done and was very impressed. He felt that the vitality in your paintings can't easily be found elsewhere."
"I don't get it. How could an ordinary person have seen several of my portraits? It's not like I have a one-man show at a gallery every year."
"I really don't know the details," he said, sounding perplexed. "I'm just passing along what the other party told me. I told him up front that you were no longer doing portraits. I said you seemed pretty firm about it. And even if I asked you, you'd most likely turn him down. But he wouldn't give up. That's when this figure came up." I mulled over the offer. Honestly, it was a tempting amount, and I felt a bit of pride that someone saw that much value in my paintings, even if it was work I'd done half mechanically for money. But the thing was, I'd sworn I'd never paint commissioned portraits again. When my wife left me, it spurred me to start over again, and I couldn't reverse my decision just because somebody was willing to shell out a pile of money.
"Why is he being so generous?" I asked.
"Even though we're in a recession, there are still people who have so much money they don't know what to do with it. There are a lot of people like that, ones who made a killing in online stock trading or tech entrepreneurs, and getting a portrait done is something they can write off as a business expense."
"Write off?"
"In their accounts, a portrait isn't included as a work of art, but as office equipment."
"Talk about heartwarming," I said.
"But even if they have tons of excess cash, and even if they can write it off as a business expense, I can't see entrepreneurs or people who've made a fortune trading stocks online wanting to have their portraits painted and hung on their company walls as office equipment. Most of these are young people decked out at work in faded jeans, sneakers, worn t-shirts, and Banana Republic jackets, proud to be drinking Starbucks from a paper cup. An imposing oil portrait didn't fit their lifestyle. But there are all kinds in the world. You can't generalize. It's not necessarily true that no one wants to be painted sipping Starbucks, or whatever, coffee, fair trade beans only, of course, from a paper cup.
But there's one condition, the agent said. The other party wants you to use the client as a live model and paint when you're actually together. They'll make the time to do that.
But I don't work that way.
I know you meet the client but don't have them model for you. That's your way of working. I told them that. They said they understood, but they'd like you to make an exception and paint the client live and in person. That's the other party's condition.
What's the purpose?
I don't know.
That's a pretty odd request. Why would they insist on that? You'd think they'd be happy not to actually have to sit for the portrait.
I agree it's unconventional, but it's hard to complain about the fee.
I'm with you there. Hard to complain about the fee, I agreed.
It's all up to you. It's not like you're being asked to sell your soul or anything. You're a very skilled portrait painter, and they're counting on that skill.
I feel like a retired hitman in the mob, I said, like I'm being asked to whack one more target.
Though no blood's going to be shed. What do you say? Will you do it?
No blood's going to be shed, I silently repeated. The painting Killing Commendatore came to mind.
What sort of person is the one I'd paint? I asked.
Actually, I don't know.
You don't even know if it's a man or a woman?
I don't. I haven't heard a thing about the sex or age or name. At this point, he's a totally faceless client.
A lawyer saying he was representing the client called me. That's the other party I spoke with about it.
Do you think it's legit?
I don't see anything suspect about it. The lawyer works at a reputable firm and said they'll transfer in advance as soon as you accept.
Phone in hand, I sighed. This is kind of sudden, and I don't think I can give you an answer right away. I need time to think.
Understood. Think about it as long as you need. It's not an urgent job, the other party said.
I thanked him and hung up. I couldn't think of anything else to do, so I went to the studio, turned on the light, plunked myself down on the floor, and stared vaguely at Killing Commendatore. After a while, I started to get hungry and went to the kitchen, piled a plate with Ritz crackers and ketchup, and went back to the studio. I dipped the crackers in the ketchup and munched them as I went back to staring at the painting. Nothing about that food tasted good. It was, if anything, pretty awful. But taste wasn't the issue. Keeping hunger at bay for a while was the priority. That's how much the painting drew me in. From the overall composition to the small details, it truly held me captive. After a few weeks of exhaustive gazing at the painting, I ventured closer to it to inspect each detail. What most caught my attention were the expressions on each of the five people's faces. I did minute pencil sketches of each of them. From the Commendatore to Don Giovanni, Donna Anna, Leporello, and Longface. Just like a reader might carefully copy down in a notebook each word and phrase he liked in a book. This was the first time I'd ever sketched figures from a Japanese-style painting, and it was far more difficult than I'd expected. Japanese painting emphasized lines and tended to be more flat than three-dimensional. Symbolism was emphasized over reality. It's inherently impossible to transfer a painting done from that perspective into the grammar of Western painting, though after much trial and error, I was able to do a fairly decent job of it. Calling it recasting might be a bit much, but it was necessary to interpret and translate the painting in my own way, which necessitated grasping the intent that went into the original painting. I had to come to an understanding of Tomohiko Amada, his viewpoint as an artist, and the kind of person he was. Figuratively speaking, I had to put myself in his shoes. After I'd done this for a while, the thought struck me. Maybe doing a portrait again wasn't such a bad idea. I mean, my painting wasn't going anywhere. I couldn't even get a hint of what I should paint or what I wanted to paint. Even if I wasn't too keen on the job, getting my hands moving again wouldn't be a bad thing. If I kept on like this, unable to draw a thing, I might find myself unable to paint ever again. Maybe I wouldn't even be able to paint a portrait. The fee, of course, was also pretty tempting. My living expenses at this point were minimal, but my pay from the art classes wasn't enough to cover them. I'd gone on that long trip, bought a used Corolla station wagon, and my savings were diminishing. So a sizable fee like the one I'd get from doing the portrait was, admittedly, very appealing. I called my agent and told him that just this one time, I would take on the job. Naturally, he was happy to hear this. But if I have to paint the client in person, that means I need to travel to wherever he is, I said. No need to worry about that. The other party will come to your place in Odawara.
To Odawara?
That's right.
He knows where I'm living?
He apparently lives nearby. He even knows that you're living in Tomohiko Amada's place.
This left me speechless.
That's strange. Hardly anybody knows I'm living here, especially that I'm in Amada's house.
I didn't know that either, the agent said.
Then how does that person know?
I have no idea, but you can find out just about anything from the internet these days. For people who know their way around it, privacy is a thing of the past.
Is it just a coincidence that that person lives near me? Or was the fact that I live nearby one of the reasons he chose me?
That I couldn't say. When you meet the client, if there's something you want to know, you can ask.
I'll do that, I said.
So when can you start? He asked.
Anytime, I said.
All right, I'll let them know and get back to you, the agent said.
After I hung up, I went out to the terrace, settled into the lounge chair, and thought about how things had turned out. The more I mulled it over, the more questions I had. First off, it bothered me that the client knew I was living here in this house. It was like I was under surveillance, with somebody watching my every move. But why would anyone have that much interest in a person like me? Plus, the whole thing sounded too good to be true. The portraits I'd done were certainly well received, and I had a certain amount of confidence in them, but these were ultimately the kind of portraits you could find anywhere. No way you could ever call them works of art. And as far as the world was concerned, I was a completely unknown artist. No matter how many of my paintings someone had seen and liked, not that I accepted that story at face value, would that person really shell out such an enormous fee? A thought suddenly struck me out of nowhere. Could the client be the husband of the woman I was having an affair with? I had no proof to go on, yet the more I thought about it, the more it seemed like a real possibility. When it came to an anonymous neighbor who was interested in me, that's all I could come up with. But why would her husband go to the trouble and expense of paying a huge fee to have his wife's lover paint his own portrait? It didn't add up, unless he was some weird pervert or something. Fine. If that's how things are working out, then just go with the flow. If the client has some hidden agenda, just let it play out. That was a much more sensible thing to do than remaining as I was, stuck, deadlocked in the mountains. Curiosity was also a factor. What kind of person was this client? What did he want from me in exchange for the huge fee? I had to discover what motivated him. Once I'd made up my mind, I felt relieved. That night, for the first time in a while, I fell into a deep sleep right away, with no thoughts buzzing around in my head. At one point, I felt like I heard the rustling of the horned owl in the middle of the night, but that might have just been a piece of a fragmentary dream. Chapter 7. For better or for worse, it's an easy name to remember. My agent in Tokyo called a few more times, and we decided that I would meet our mystery client on Tuesday afternoon of the following week. At that point, the client's name was still not revealed. I had them agree to my usual procedure, wherein, on the first day, we simply met and talked together for an hour or so, before we embarked upon a drawing. As you might imagine, painting a portrait requires the ability to accurately grasp the special features of a person's face. But that's not all. If it were, you'd end up with a caricature. To paint a vibrant portrait, you need the skill to discover what lies at the core of the person's face. A face is like reading a palm. More than the features you're born with, a face is gradually formed over the passage of time, through all the experiences a person goes through, and no two faces are alike. On Tuesday morning, I straightened up the house, picked some flowers from the garden and put them in vases, moved the Killing Commendatore painting out of the studio into the guest bedroom, and wrapped it up again in brown paper. I didn't want anyone else seeing it. At 1:05 p.m., a car drove up the steep slope and parked in the covered driveway at the entrance. A heavy, brazen-sounding engine echoed, like some giant animal giving a satisfied purr from deep inside a cave. A high-powered engine. The engine shut off, and quiet again settled over the valley. The car was a silver Jaguar sports coupe. Sunlight from between the clouds reflected brightly off the long, brightly polished fenders. I'm not that into cars, so I don't know which model this was, but my guess was that it was the latest model, the mileage in the four digits, the price 20 times what I paid for my used Corolla station wagon. Not that this surprised me. The client was, after all, willing to pay such a huge fee to have a portrait done. If he'd appeared at my door in a massive yacht, it wouldn't have been surprising. The person who got out of the car was a well-dressed, middle-aged man. He had on dark green sunglasses, a long-sleeved white cotton shirt, not simply white, but a pure white, and khaki chinos. His shoes were cream-colored deck shoes. He was probably a shade over 5'7" tall. His face had a nice, even tan. He gave off an overall fresh, clean feel. But what struck me most on this first encounter was his hair. Slightly curly and thick, it was white down to the last hair. Not gray or salt and pepper, but a pure white, like freshly fallen virgin snow. He got out of the car, closed the door, which made that special, pleasant thunk expensive car doors make when you casually shut them, didn't lock it, but put the key in his trouser pocket, and strode toward my front door, all of which I watched from a gap in the curtains. The way he walked was quite lovely, back straight, the necessary muscles all equally in play. I figured he must work out regularly, and pretty hard training at that. I stepped away from the window, sat in a chair in the living room, and waited for the front doorbell to ring. Once it did, I slowly walked to the door and opened it. When I opened the door, the man took off his sunglasses, slipped them into the breast pocket of his shirt, and without a word, held out his hand. Half reflexively, I held out my hand too. He shook it. It was a firm handshake, the way Americans do it. A little too firm for me, not that it hurt or anything. "My name is Manshiki. It's very nice to meet you," the man said in a clear voice, the sort of tone a lecturer would make at the beginning of his talk to test the microphone and introduce himself at the same time. "The pleasure's mine," I said. "Mr. Manshiki?" The men is written with the character in Menzaten, the one that means avoidance, and the Shiki is the character Iro, for color. "Mr. Manshiki," I repeated, lining the two characters up in my mind. A strange combination.
Avoiding colors is what it means, the man said. An unusual name. Other than my relatives, I rarely run across anyone who shares it. But it's easy to remember.
Exactly. It's an easy name to remember. For better or for worse.
The man smiled. He had faint stubble from his cheeks to his chin, but I don't think he'd simply left off shaving. When he'd shaved, he'd left an exact, calculated amount of stubble. Different from his hair, his beard was half black. I found it odd that only his hair was pure white.
Please come in, I said.
Menchiki gave a small nod, removed his shoes, and stepped inside. The way he carried himself was charming, though I could sense a bit of tension. Like some large cat taken to a new place, each movement was careful and light, his eyes darting quickly around to take in his surroundings.
A comfortable-looking place, he said, after sitting down on the sofa. Very relaxed and quiet.
Quiet it certainly is, but kind of inconvenient when you have to go shopping.
I would imagine for someone in your field it's an ideal environment.
I sat down in the chair across from him.
I heard that you live nearby, Mr. Menchiki?
Yes, that's right.
It would take a while to walk here, though as the crow flies, it's actually pretty near.
As the crow flies, I said, repeating his words. There was a somehow strange ring to the expression.
But how near is it actually?
Close enough that if you wave your hand here, you could see it.
You can see your house from here?
Exactly.
I wasn't sure how to respond, and Menchiki asked,
Would you like to see my house?
If I could, yes, I said.
Do you mind if we go out on the terrace?
Please, go right ahead.
Menchiki got up from the sofa and went straight from the living room to the terrace. He leaned out over the railing and pointed across the valley.
You see that white concrete house over there? The one on top of the mountain? With the shiny windows?
I was speechless. That was the house, that smart, elegant house I often looked at when I went out at sunset onto the terrace to enjoy a glass of wine. The large house that stood out from all the rest, diagonally to the right from mine.
It's a little far, but if you made a big wave with your hand, you could say hello, Menchiki said.
But how did you know I was living here? I asked, resting my hands on the railing.
He looked puzzled. He wasn't really fazed, just displaying a puzzled look. Not that his expression seemed contrived. He'd simply wanted to throw in a pause before responding.
One aspect of my job is gathering all kinds of information, he said. That's the sort of business I'm in.
Is it tech-related?
That's right. Or more precisely, that's also one aspect of my work.
But hardly anyone knows yet that I'm living here.
Menchiki smiled.
Saying hardly anyone knows means, paradoxically, that there are some who do.
I looked over again at that exquisite white concrete building across the valley, and once more studied the man beside me. He was, most likely, the one who appeared almost every evening on the deck of that house. When I thought of it, his shape and movements all fit that silhouette perfectly. It was hard to figure out his age. That snow-white hair made me think he must be in his late 50s or early 60s, though his skin was lustrous and tight and wrinkle-free. His deep-looking eyes had the youthful twinkle of a man in his late 30s, all of which made guessing his age a tough call. I would have accepted anything between 45 and 60. Menchiki went back to the sofa in the living room, and I sat down again across from him.
Do you mind if I ask a question? I finally ventured.
Ask away, he said, beaming.
Is there some connection between the fact that I live near your house and your decision to ask me to paint your portrait? A slight look of confusion came over him, and when he looked confused, several tiny wrinkles appeared at the corners of his eyes. Charming wrinkles. His features, viewed individually, were all quite attractive. The eyes almond-shaped and slightly deep-set, the forehead noble and broad, the eyebrows thick and nicely defined, the nose thin and a nice size. Eyes, eyebrows, and nose that perfectly fit his smallish face. His face was a bit small, yet too broad in a way, and from a purely aesthetic viewpoint, was a little imbalanced. The vertical and horizontal were out of sync, though this disparity wasn't necessarily a defect. It's what gave his face its distinctiveness, since it was this imbalance that conversely gave the viewer a sense of calm. If his features had been too perfectly symmetrical, people might have felt a bit of antipathy or wariness toward him. But as it was, his ever so slightly unbalanced features had a calming effect on anyone meeting him for the first time. They broadcast in a friendly way, "It's all good, not to worry. I'm not a bad person. I don't plan to do anything bad to you." The pointed, largish tips of his ears were slightly visible through his neatly trimmed hair. They conveyed a sense of freshness, of vigor, reminding me of spry little mushrooms in a forest, peeking out from among the fallen leaves on an autumn morning just after it had rained. His mouth was broad, the thin lips neatly closed in a line, diligently prepared to, at any moment, break into a smile. One could call him handsome, and he actually was, yet his features rejected that sort of casual description, neatly circumventing it. His face was too lively, its movements too subtle to simply abide by that label. The expressions that rose on his features weren't calculated, but looked more like they'd arisen naturally, spontaneously. If they weren't, then he was quite the actor. But I got the impression that wasn't the case. When I observe the face of a person I've met for the first time, from habit I sense all sorts of things. In most cases, there's no tangible basis for how I feel. It's nothing more than intuition. But that's what helps me as a portrait artist. That simple intuition. "The answer is yes and no," Menshiki said. His hands on his knees were wide open, palms up. He turned them over. I said nothing, waiting for his next words. "I do worry about who lives in the neighborhood," Menshiki went on. "No, not worry, exactly. It's more like I'm interested, especially when it's someone I see now and then across the valley." It's a little too great a distance to say we actually see each other, I thought, but didn't say anything. Maybe he had high-powered binoculars and had been secretly observing me? I kept that thought to myself. I mean, what possible reason could he have to observe a person like me? "And I learned that you had moved in here," Menshiki continued. "I found out you're a professional portrait artist, and that aroused my interest enough to seek out a few of your paintings. At first, I saw them on the internet, but I wasn't satisfied. So I went to see three actual paintings." That had me puzzled. "You saw the actual paintings?" "I went to see the people who had modeled for you and asked them to let me see the portraits. They were happy to show me them. It seems like people who sit for portraits are really pleased to show them off. I got a strange sensation when I saw the actual paintings up close and compared them to the faces of the people. It's like I couldn't tell which one was real anymore. How should I put it? There's something about your paintings that strikes the viewer's heart from an unexpected angle. At first, they seem like ordinary, typical portraits, but if you look carefully, you see something hidden inside them." Something hidden? I asked.
I'm not sure how to put it. Maybe the real personality?